Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, I'm Seth Meyers, and welcome to another episode of Late Night Lit, our podcast series that dives deep into the world of literature and authors. Spring is almost here, but the pandemic isn't quite over yet. So if you're anything like us, there's still plenty of reading to do at home. I'm going to turn things over to our own Sarah Jenks Daly, who interviews two great authors on today's episode. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, and welcome to Late Night Lit. This month, we are thrilled to speak with Helen Oyeyemi, an award-winning and best-selling author who appeared on Late Night in 2016 to talk about her book, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours. And we're thrilled to welcome her back here. Her latest work, Pieces, is her seventh book, and is mysterious, strange, and beautiful. We also talk with writer and performer Jen Spira, author of the very funny new book, Big Time, a collection of fictional stories that are equal parts hysterical, insane, and delightful. And finally, some late night staffers share what they've been reading lately. Pieces is Helen Oyeyemi's seventh book, and follows a couple, Otto and Xavier, as they embark upon what is certainly the strangest train ride of their life. Helen's writing is always unique and brilliant, and this latest iteration is no exception. Pieces is a mystery and a story about relationships, memories, and connections, wrapped up in fantastic and surreal circumstances. Now, here's my conversation with Helen. Helen, hello. Welcome to Late Night Lit. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. I'm very excited.
I'm very excited, too. We actually met in May of 2016, which was unbelievably 5 years ago. And you came on Late Night to talk about your book, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours. And since then, you've written two more books, including this last one that I really loved. It seems, at least to me as like an outsider, that you're pretty prolific in terms of creating and writing. Is that accurate, do you think?
No, I actually think I'm the laziest person who just behaves like an unemployed person for like 1 year, and then for another year I'm very intensely working. So it's these kind of spurts of really intense activity followed by just months of watching films and lounging around and walking and going to art galleries and things like that. So it's a kind of slightly divided existence.
So you do struggle with procrastination like the rest of us.
Hugely. But I think the main thing is that once I get into a project, I really go with it to the end. So it's sort of all in or all out.
Did you find the last year or so difficult in terms of being able to be inspired? Because like you said, if you were walking around art galleries, those types of things might not have been available to you.
These are the things I hugely miss. And it's simultaneously grateful and very dissatisfied by the way that all of the art experiences have moved online, because I'm just convinced that part of the experience of visiting a gallery is actually the journey from your home to the gallery and everything that you walk past and all the people that you encounter. I feel like it's a 3D construction that it's just really missing when you sit at your computer and you just click around some exhibitions. So I think that's what I'm really missing. And I'm also really missing the experience of being focused on something with other people who are not speaking to me. I just love that. It's the same with the cinema. That kind of collective concentration is something that I feel that I need to get going on a lot of my projects. And I'm hoping for galleries to open again before I start my, I'm going to start another book in June. So I'm hoping that I can get some collective strength before that.
Well, maybe you can come to New York because we do have some things open here.
What's open?
A few museums are open now. I actually went to the Museum of Natural History not too long ago, and it's certainly strange, but there was something kind of special. Like you said, I hadn't heard that collective concentration. I love that so much. But there's something special, too, about being able to walk around in a museum that felt sort of empty in a way, but you were still there with people. I got to see more of it than I ever had, which was nice.
Mm-hmm. Also, there are some perks. Maybe
far less.
Yeah, unless maybe we'll permanently change our museum experience where we just have a more concentrated, like, group of small groups of people moving around.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll see. Hopefully we can get some good out of some of this. I also read that during this time, you, like I think probably most of us, found some solace in watching television. And I wasn't very aware of how popular the Eurovision Song Contest was until recently. But I read this is something you were slightly invested in.
Yes, slightly. Eurovision is life. Eurovision is love. And one of the sad things about being in Czechia, practically the only sad thing, because Prague is the city of my dreams, is that nobody really cares about Eurovision here. I'm just like, we're in the heart of Europe. Like, we need to really step up our effort and our representation here. And everyone's just like, no, it's a really tacky contest. And I'm like, no, the tackiness is love. The tackiness is joy. So I'm trying to sort of drum up some enthusiasm, but it's not like I can have a Eurovision party this year, but hopefully next year I will try and recruit some enthusiastic dancers, probably from other countries, to come in and show Czechs how to get excited about Eurovision.
Where do you think it is most popular?
Germany. I remember huge Eurovision parties in Berlin, but Berlin is kind of like everybody will have a party for anything. So there's that. London also, I feel like it was very much my window growing up into even being European. There were all of these countries that I'd never heard of. Like, I don't think I would have heard of Azerbaijan just like casually. But it's seeing each country and how they want to present themselves, and not just how they want to present themselves for the year, because it changes so differently. So it's as if everybody shows up at this gathering and says, this is the kind of year that we've had. And some people are just sort of dancing wildly, and some have these melancholy ballads, and yeah, it's glorious.
That's so great. There was a film that Will Ferrell made this past year. And that was kind of my real introduction to it. Maybe that was just me being naive, but I really did not know that much about it until watching that film.
How did you feel about it when you watched the film? Very curious.
I thought it was so insane. But then I went into this deep Google dive and it ended up being so much fun. Like you said, it really is so joyous. And that was kind of those YouTube videos I saw brought that out, I think.
I'm so happy.
Okay, so let's get to your book. It takes place on a train, and a very strange train. I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't read it yet, but I read that you feel that train stories are inherently connected to mysteries. So I wanted to know if you could tell us kind of how this idea of telling a story on a train came about for you.
I think it might have just been that I wanted to take a lot of train trips and call it research. I was just very into train travel and going as far as I could from Prague. Again, it's this sense of being in the heart of Europe, connected to various countries. Like, you can take trains to Hungary, to Germany, to Austria, and just watching the way that things change at the border is always fascinating to me. I'm always trying to see when I have crossed over from one country to another, and it's the most practical but also romantic way to do it, just on a train. Like, it's really not the same with like air travel or even road trips. And yeah, there were a lot of good train stories. I had been reading Olga Tokarczuk's Flights, where she sort of meditates a little bit on train travel and how when you're on a train, you really have to move with the train, like you're crossing the ground with the wheels moving. Like, it's a very physical experience in a way that other types of travel aren't. And yeah, I wanted to try my hand at it, especially this notion of characters being connected by being in the same carriage and not necessarily knowing what their connections were and seeing how that web would develop.
Did you end up doing a lot of train travel for research?
I did. I did a lot of train travel. I don't know if I can call it research, but I would like to think that the atmosphere of the train trips that I took went into pieces. There was definitely I'm a very confused and disorganized train traveler, like always missing stops, always being completely turned around, never really knowing quite where I am or where I'm supposed to be or whether I missed my stop two stations back and getting off too early sometimes as well. So it was just this kind of like jumble of me and my luggage and trying to get to where I was and where I was supposed to be. And
when we are able to gather together again and have a lifestyle resembling more of what we used to, are there places you've dreamed of traveling on trains to that you will go to before perhaps you start writing again in June or after the summer?
I would really love to ride the Orient Express. Like, I don't know if it's possible to just ride it and actually be there now, just because there are so many stories and there's like so much of an idea of what it is. So I think that I might just be lost in the glamour of it and miss the actual train journey while I'm taking it. But I would love to go to Venice on the Orient Express. And then there are others, like the Trans-Siberian Railway, but I think I'm a little bit afraid just because the space that it crosses is just so vast. Mm-hmm. And because I know that I get lost so easily. I don't know. What was interesting was that last year during the summer, when there was like a tiny window when we weren't locked down, I took trains to Slovakia. I'd never been to Slovakia. I lived in the Czech Republic for 8 years and had never been to Slovakia, which is just like, it used to be one country with Czechia. So I kind of felt like I didn't have an excuse for not going. And I went to Košice, which is this town that was, all I knew was that it was like a 6-hour direct train ride from Prague. And it was just lovely. It was strange and kind of industrial, but like abandoned industrial.
Oh, wow.
You know, I just loved it out there. I spent some time wandering around this mafia graveyard that had like these huge portraits of like the people that were in the graves, like larger than life portraits.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. You sound like a good person to travel with.
Yeah, because I'm just like lost and enjoying it.
And just very, very interesting places, things I would never think of. So I might hit you up the next time I'm looking for some inspiration for travel.
Do.
I also wanted to know the two main characters in the story. I read that you initially thought you might treat them a little more harshly than you ultimately did. What was your initial thought process there and why did you change your mind?
I had just come to a point where I felt that I was forever alone and I had this couple going on a honeymoon and, you know, they'd found each other and I just was really cross with them and upset and thought that I was going to use this as an example to like make myself feel better about being single. Like, being single is better than being in a couple if you're going to go on a terrible honeymoon. And then they just kept like loving each other and stuff and I just went along with it. They dragged me into a better mood and it was supposed to be the other way around. I was supposed to ruin their mood.
I love that. There's another character in the book that is not a person, but named Arpod, right? Is that how you say the name? And Arpod is a mongoose. I have to admit that while reading, I was searching to see if mongooses actually made good pets. And I think the only thing I knew about a mongoose was some old story I read in school about the foe of a snake.
Yeah.
And I want to know what your sort of research was into this mongoose character.
Was the story that, you know, Rikki Tikki Tavi, the mongoose is in the Jungle Book?
That was the story, yes.
Yeah, I didn't actually think of Rikki Tikki Tavi until like after, suddenly there was a mongoose in the book. Like, I just don't know what happened or how, but there was suddenly a mongoose and I was like, okay, there's a mongoose. And then there were two and I was like, okay, there are two. And like, it was just, I thought, are they going to keep multiplying? But it stopped at two. And I did, after I realized there was a mongoose in the book, start watching YouTube videos and like listening to mongooses and like watching the ways that they moved. But really, it wasn't a conscious choice to bring a mongoose into the story. A mongoose came of his own accord.
Oh, that's so great. I love the book so much. I think you're such a wonderful writer, and I'm so glad that you are able to talk to us today. I wanted to ask before you go if there are any books that you've read recently or that you'd like to recommend to our listeners.
Mariana Enriquez's The Dangers of Smoking in Bed. It's a short story collection from Mariana Enriquez, and it's just, you feel your brain and your fingertips tingling as you read it. I love it so much. And this one isn't going to be out until July, but I just finished Nick McDonald's The Council of Animals.
Okay.
And I don't even know what to say about it, except that I just love it. It's set in the possibly not too distant future. Representatives of several species of mammal get together to decide on whether or not to get rid of humans, and everything just like plays out from there, and it just flows, and read it.
Okay, I will read it. Thank you so much for joining us. It was so nice to speak to you. And for everyone listening, Pieces is available now wherever books are sold, but please remember to support your local and independent bookstores. Thank you, Helen.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
We'll be right back with Jen Spira.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Jen Spira has written for The Onion, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, The New Yorker, The New York Times, and many, many more. Her debut collection of stories, Big Time, was published in March and is a wonderful escape from reality, not to mention it is so funny. Now, here's my conversation with Jen. Hi, Jen. Welcome to Late Night Lit.
Sarah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for doing this. You wrote a book and it's very, very funny.
Oh, boy.
I was wondering if you get tired of people telling you that.
Oh, my God. I love that question because I was just talking about this with friends who, you know that I used to work on Colbert. And I was wondering, do famous people ever get tired of you if you go up to them and you say anything? For me, no. I want to hear this all day long and I want to hear it when I sleep. I love it. So thank you for telling me that.
This is a collection, for those who haven't read it, it's called Big Time. It's a collection of hysterical, maybe like slightly deranged, odd, weird stories. I was thinking this probably isn't something you conceive of and then think, oh, this is definitely a great idea for a book. What were the steps to get you to believe that this could be a book?
Totally. I mean, the first step was even just getting one-page humor pieces in The New Yorker. That was like the first official stamp of, okay, you can do these little shorties and someone is going to buy them. And then, I mean, I've just always been a fan of short, funny stories. And I feel like there's not a lot of these collections, but I mean, Simon Rich writes some of my favorites, Jack Handy. I was such a big fan of this type of writing. And so getting the one-pagers in The New Yorker was the first step. And then it was, I mean, for me, it was like, before I had the book deal, I was writing these. And, you know, I was writing them when I was at writing on the staff at Colbert. And it was just such a fun, no-rules world where there was no pre-established editorial voice. I had to squish my voice in. And indeed, it wasn't TV. Nothing had to be TV-friendly. And it was such a fun release. But I just am a huge fan of the form and really wanted to write just like funny, see if I could sustain a funny story for longer than a page. That was like the initial challenge. And then I kind of in baby steps saw, ooh, I can do it for 6 pages. Ooh, I can do it for 10. Ooh, I can do it for 30. Can I do it for 100? So that was like the challenge that kept growing.
Now that the book's out in the world and people have started reading it, have you heard about favorites? Like, do people come up to you and talk to you about specific ones?
Yes. And actually, it's been shocking and so heartening because the ones that are people's favorites are the ones that I wasn't even sure if I should include because I thought they were so deranged.
Like
one is Birthday Girl. Mm-hmm. And I was very scared to show it to my editor because I really respect my editors at Random House so much. These two guys, they're so smart and funny. And I was scared because I was like, are they just going to be like, what is this? You know, so there's that story, Birthday Girl. And there's another story that's based on the, you know, on Goosebumps. It's sort of like it's a riff on a Goosebumps, on an R.L. Stine story. And oddly, that one, people really like that one as well. And these are the weirder, way more experimental stories in the collection. And I was so impressed that those were resonating.
Mine were not those favorites. Mine were...
Yes, I love this.
What were 1,000 Days and Nights.
Thank you.
My favorite.
Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate that. I love that one too. And I'm like, I feel like maybe one person has said that to me, but it's like super, that's a cool deep cut.
Well, I also loved how you made fun of some TV shows in there and like pop culture. There were a lot of like underlying nuggets that I felt really came out.
First and Second Kid was right after that. I loved that one. And then I loved Plus One, the boyfriend project. I loved that one too. I think those are my top three right in a row.
That's amazing. And the boyfriend identity is less of a deep cut because, yes, that is one that people are mentioning to me. And that one, actually, The New Yorker, I gave them the book and we have this relationship. And so they chose that one to serialize. They actually published it in three parts, The Boyfriend Identity. That was actually one that I also asked my editor before the book went to press. I was like, should we just like pull it? I don't know if it's, does that make sense for this? And he was a big fan. So I was like, okay, but I love that you love 1001 Nights. That I loved
it's
that
so
story.
Fun.
Yes. It's a story about, it's like kind of like meta. It's about keeping an audience wanting mm-hmm. more. And so it was fun to play with such an iconic story. And it has such a sweet emotional core where it's like about a dad cheerleading his writer daughter, which is very similar to like my
yeah absolutely and yeah. sort of like the strange trajectory of like what being a writer's assistant, what you think that has to mean in a very odd, strange like way. I thought it was really cool.
Thank you, that's awesome.
The story that I mentioned, The First and Second Kid, that one plus The Birthday sort of caused me to wonder, some of these things that you write about are events that happen to us that we've seen, like a gender reveal where it's very present in pop culture, and you sort yes. of see people like kind of going off the deep end in ways that they celebrate or decide to talk about certain things. Yes. How much of this, if any, came from friends or colleagues or things you've seen in real life?
All of it, honey. All of it. I mean, it's funny because it's true that the stories, they go to such silly places and they can feel zany, but they're all so just grounded in real stuff. And the birthday girl story is, I mean, it's so funny because I'm both, there's so much of it that's autobiographical. Number one, the sort of initial germ for the idea was just this observation I had about A, myself, and B, culture. Myself, I am a birthday monster girl. You know, like it's never enough. And before the birthday starts, I'm just thinking of how it's not going to be enough and the different people that I'm going to be pissed at, you know, that didn't come through. But then at the same time, the self-disgust and the I'm 35, like what is my problem? Like that I need to be celebrated like I'm six. And then of course, you see that, you know, your birthday week and your birthday month, that's the thing that's in the culture. I mean, like, mm-hmm. it's not just me. And so I'm making fun of this instinct in myself. At the same time, I was in one of these like popular girl groups in high school where there's a queen bee and everyone is kind of humming around her, figuring out their role. Mm-hmm. And so thinking of how a group like that might evolve into adulthood, these things kind of got mashed together. But pretty much all the stuff that I make fun of is stuff that I am obsessed with and ashamed of.
That makes sense. And I think it's become so big, too, just due to social media. You just see so much more of people's lives and they share more. But then you just see it and then you think, should I be sharing this?
Totally. And actually, yeah, that is, I mean, I lurk on Instagram and I love to lurk, but it's the one social media platform where I'm like, you know what? I can't do that, too, because what am I going to do? I'm going to spend all my time on this. So I have to do Twitter because as a comedy writer, you just kind of have to. But, mm-hmm. and I love that people do Instagram because I spend a huge amount of my day looking every single day. But if I also were involved in curating me, when the hell am I going to get work done? So that's an issue for me.
So you mentioned Colbert, and I read that you've had a lot of writing jobs, I think, that many people would aspire to in terms of wanting to be a comedy writer. You worked at The Onion.
Yeah.
You worked at some TV scripted writing rooms. You did Colbert.
Yes.
Did you feel like this was a career trajectory that you could have pictured? Was this something that you were sure of?
Not at all. And it was so exhilarating coming from rooms and then going on your own. It's such a culture shock as a writer. If you're kind of bopping along and you're a writer who's working on staffs and then you get a chance to do this, it's just 100% different from what I was doing before. And I really loved it. And it a little bit scrambled my DNA because when you're on a staff, I mean, if it's not your own show, you are a team player. And this is just the opposite of being a team player. And the good part is that like every weird thing that I wanted to explore and follow, I could. And the only thing that was weird was the buck stopped with me. And so if something sucked, it's totally my fault and I couldn't blame it on somebody. But I mean,
Like you used to do in a teen.
Yeah, of course. You just kind of like look at the executive producer and you're like, it was, you know, sorry, he's not that great. So no, you could always blame somebody. But ultimately, though, the freedom was, it's like a drug for someone that comes from a land of, you know, rules. I mean, not even just the sensibility of your host or of the publication like The Onion, but just like if you're writing for a network, I mean, there's so many rules, as you know. And so this was like an unleashing, and that was very fun.
Yeah. I know a very cool thing that you still do is that you're the voice, the announcer for
Alicia. Oh my God. It's so cool.
How did that start?
Oh, that is the happiest little accident where sometimes if I'm like mentally whining and I'm pissed that I'm not getting my due, as like anytime I'm walking and I'm just sort of, I start to think about how I should have more, you know, everything. And then I just like, that little thing is so lucky because, I mean, it started because Stephen just asked me one day really early on when the show started if I wanted to do it. And he only had the idea in his head, I think, because he had heard me do voiceover for, when I was at The Onion, I did voiceover for a bunch of our videos. And that happened because someone just came up to me in the office and was like, would you do this? And I was like, sure. I mean, so I started there. Stephen somehow heard them. And then in the beginning of the show, he asked me, and he had done it a few times himself in the beginning of the show. And I thought that was funny and a fun kind of vestige of his old character from The Rapport. Right. And I was like, I think it's funnier, honestly, if you keep doing it. But he was like, you know, I just don't have the time. So I was like, sure. And I do it. It's the easiest. It's so easy. And it's like,
what does it look like now? Because, well, you're at home.
I have done it in the most weird little places. I mean, right now I'm at home and I just do it in the closet. It's no big deal. But I mean, I've done it a lot on the road since there's been a lot of traveling. And so my husband, who's my audio guy for this for sure, we do this thing where we bring all of the equipment with us on the road, and I like basically lay down in the seat and I have the mic in my hands, and it's actually pretty painless. And I mean, a lot of hotel closets. I've just, you know, as long as you got a closet and a towel, there we are. Yeah.
I'd love to know, lastly, if there's anything that you've read recently that you've really loved and would want to share with our listeners.
That's a great question. And yes, actually, just a few days ago, I read the debut novel from Patricia Lockwood. It's called No One Is Talking About This. I had the pleasure and honor of doing an in-conversation event with her around my book tour. And she started off as a poet. The writing is, it reminds me of that Missy Elliott song where she's like, sex me so good, I say blah, blah, blah. Because it's like, write me so good, I say blah, blah, blah. You just read it and you're like, you want to like smush your head in the book. And then the other thing I would love to recommend is, I'm freaking out about these stories. I never read Roald Dahl's stories for adults. He has these short stories that he wrote before he wrote the kid stuff, and they are so inventive and shockingly funny and deliciously mean. And so I just bought like a compilation where I just got as many as I could in there, like just a fat book. So I literally am reading the best of Roald Dahl.
I didn't even know that existed.
I didn't either. I knew that he wrote some stuff for adults, but I never knew where to start. It's his short stories. They're just like, they're like nobody else.
Well, I think your short stories are like nobody else. So that's a nice button for this. Thank you so much for doing this. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Sarah, thank you so much. It was wonderful for me to be here.
And for everybody listening, Big Time is available wherever you buy books, but please support local and independent bookstores. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Our late night staff is full of readers, and we asked Ron McClary and Kiana Watkins about what they've been digging into lately. So here are a couple of book recommendations from Ron and Kiana.
Hi there, I'm Ron McClary, the announcer for Late Night with Seth Meyers, and my book recommendation is The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen, and it's a memoir by Chef Jacques Pepin. If you're a foodie like me, you already know Jacques Pepin is one of the original TV chefs from his many cooking shows on public television throughout the years. But did you know before that he was the private chef for President Charles de Gaulle in France? or that he turned down an offer to be John F. Kennedy's private chef at the White House to work for Howard Johnson's restaurants instead? Well, those are just a few facts from his amazing life story. If you love food and cooking, you will love this book. But at its heart, it's also an amazing immigrant story. I really have such admiration for people who have the courage to leave everything they know behind and travel to a new country to search for a better life and pursue their dreams. Chef Pepin's journey from growing up in a small village in France during World War II to become one of the most revered chefs in America is amazing and very inspiring. There's also some really great recipes in it, including the best fondue in the world. So I hope you'll check it out. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Kiana, and I'm the receptionist here at Late Night. The book I recently finished and highly recommend is The Defining Decades, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now by Dr. Meg Jay. Dr. Meg Jay is a psychologist who's worked with 20-year-olds for nearly two decades and shares the different circumstances and mindsets between 20-somethings years ago and now. And as someone in my 20s, I think there is this general pressure we put on ourselves to be successful and have everything all figured out right away. And it's really reassuring to hear Dr. Jay speak on the importance of this decade and provide the tools necessary to make the most of your 20s. In the book, she shows us how work, relationships, personality, identity, and even the brain can change more during this decade than any other time in adulthood if we use the time well. I recommend it highly.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Helen Oyeyemi, Jen Spira, Kat Spillane, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, and Ross Leupold. Our theme music was written and performed by the HE Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.